I need to have a spooky entrance, like
boo.
When I was little, we used to move all the time. I would write these notes, and I would fold them up really small, and I would hide them.
Hello, and welcome to the Sound Barrier podcast from Silent London. The Sound Barrier podcast is released fortnightly, or thereabouts, and each episode discusses two films, a new release and a classic from the silent era that complements it or matches it in some way. And you should know by now that we do this with spoilers. To find out more, visit silentlondon.co.uk or search for Silent London on iTunes or Stitcher. The Sound Barrier is hosted by me, Pamela Hutchinson. I'm the editor of Silent London, and Pete Barron.
Hello.
This week, we are paying a quick visit to the afterlife with two unusual ghost films.
So David Lowery's follow-up to his excellent Disney reimagining of Pete's Dragon reunites the stars of his breakthrough movie, Ain't Them Bodies Saints, Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck. That film was praised and criticised equally for being a Terrence Malick homage, a comparison that's been thrown up about his new film too. A ghost story is deceptively simple on paper. Mara and Affleck play a couple living in a suburban one-story house, what we would call a bungalow in the UK, in the suburbs of Dallas. The film lingers on their snatch conversations. He is a musician who works from home. She wants to move, but he cannot quite articulate why he wants to stay in the house. They finally decide to move. Well, Mara does the deciding for them. But before moving day, Affleck's character is killed in a car accident. Mara goes to identify the body in the morgue and leaves. A few still moments later, Affleck's body rises under the sheets as a classic bedsheet ghost, two black cut-out eyes walking through the hospital. Offered a glowing doorway, the ghost rejects it and walks home, back to the house. We stay with the ghost for the rest of the film, as it passively watches Mara grieve, move on and move out. Generally unseen, the ghost interacts briefly with a new family that moves in, manifesting, breaking crockery, scaring them out. The house now has a reputation as haunted, as we see in a party scene, with amusing turn from Will Alden as a metaphysical party bore. Mara has slid a note into the walls which the ghost trolley slides to pick out, succeeding and failing simultaneously as the house is demolished. The ghost then lingers in the skyscraper which replaces the building, and then escapes to the past, to the same spot to watch some white settlers claim that spot, all wordless and generally impassive. Lowry's film has garnered a lot of praise for its calm, contemplative take on death and grief. We watch Mara grieve for her dead partner, but eventually move on. The ghost, however, is waiting as time telescopes, turns back on itself, rooted in this one place. The film flashes back to the relationship and eventually comes full circle, to the point where briefly the ghost haunts itself, wordlessly and silent. Lowry has created a film with a number of long sequences filled with stillness and silence. There is also an equally appropriate score where necessary. The film wouldn't feel out of place as a gallery film, and there's more than a touch of absurdist humour in there too. This deadpan cheap Halloween costume manages to temper what might start to become too precious. This reach for black humour is often brief but important, as the film lulls the audience into its own rhythms. Whilst Malick has been mentioned, particularly the more far-out special effects sequences of To the Wonder, the film has more in common with Apichatpong Wirasethakul's Uncle Boon Me, another film which treats the supernatural in a calm, matter-of-fact way. But comparisons will only take you so far. A ghost story is very much its own beast, remarkably simple, silly even in places, but powerfully moving.
And our silent rejoinder to A Ghost Story is The Phantom Carriage. Now, Victor Sjöström stars in and directs this Swedish supernatural fable from 1921, which jumps about in time, thanks to a nesting series of flashbacks, and between two realms, that of the living and the dead. Sjöström plays David Holm, an antisocial layabout and a derelict husband and father who stays away from home drinking and fatally corrupting others. He turns his younger brother into a drinker, as well as a violent thug, and intentionally spreads his consumption by coughing in the faces of strangers. The film begins on New Year's Eve with a young Salvation Army nurse called Edith, played by Astrid Holm. She is dying of TB, contracted from David, but demands to see him once before she slips away. The rest of the film traces both David's reluctant steps back to Edith's bedside and all that has passed between them in the preceding year. Edith is passionately in love with David. Perhaps, we wonder, he has really infected her with a more intimately transmitted disease and has tried to save him from alcoholism and poverty, even to reunite him with his estranged wife. Edith's interventions met with little success, but where she has failed, death itself may triumph. David is already aware of a legend that the last man to die on New Year's Eve is chosen for a grim duty, driving the phantom carriage. For the following year, and with each ghostly day lasting 100 Earth years, the driver must reap the souls of the dead. David's friend George, Torres Fenberg, was the last sinner chosen for this task, 365 days before. When David is knocked out in a drunken brawl, George arrives to hand over the reins to the carriage and listen to David's account of his dissolute year. Could this be the existential shock that David needs to mend his ways? So The Phantom Carriage is renowned as a sort of early horror film, with the soul-reaping scenes accomplished via in-camera double exposures, sometimes even quadruple exposures. These, combined with the film's rich tints and Julius Janson's stunning deep-focus cinematography, create an ethereal but really quite gorgeous effect. Now, this is really a moral drama, with David Holm trying to achieve a maturity of the soul before it's too late, and while the plotting may seem melodramatic, there is so much here that is real and tangibly painful that The Phantom Carriage succeeds on Earth as well as in the spectral realm. Sjöström is excellent in the lead role, charismatic but vicious and petty, a villain but also a sympathetic soul and so perilously close to being a lost cause. The scenes between David and his suffering wife, a chilling performance by Hilda Bergström, are particularly raw and harrowing. It's no surprise, really, that this was a favourite film of Ingmar Bergman's, who watched it once a year from the age of 15 on, no doubt taking something new from it on each viewing. Not only did he find inspiration from the Phantom Carriage's reaping scenes for 1957's The Seventh Seal, he also cast Sjöström as the lead in Wild Strawberries the same year, and later, much later, he even made a TV drama about the making of the film. It has been remade twice, by Julien Duvivier and Arne Mattsson, and you may note a similarity to the plot of, say, It's a Wonderful Life, too, and critics have regularly compared it to The Shining. Like The Exorcist, for example, this is a horror film in which the soul, not the body, is in danger. Perhaps that's why it continues to resonate, because the horror in The Phantom Carriage goes beyond our own mortality. This is a film about the fear of hell, of a soul caught in eternal torment. So this has been a fun week, Pete.
It has. Oh, these are both terrific films, though. I mean, they may be a little heavy, but they are great films.
Yeah, I think it's going to be quite hard to choose between them. If you ask me now, I don't know how this one's going to turn out.
We'll see how it goes, I guess.
So we both saw A Ghost Story in cinema, which is great.
We did, yeah.
Separate cinemas, obviously.
Yes, not at the same time. Never at the same time. No.
Can't be seen. But I have seen The Phantom Carriage on a big screen. Have you had the pleasure?
I haven't had the pleasure, sadly. I've seen it a couple of times on TV about 3 years ago, and then again for this, which I saw a version without soundtrack.
I actually had the pleasure of seeing this at the Cinémathèque Française on one of the biggest screens I've ever seen, but obviously with French intertitles, so it was nice to revisit it again with English intertitles, courtesy of Amazon Video. Yeah, so we feel these films are a good match. They're both about immortal souls. They're also about ghosts. They have some, what we might think of as low-tech special effects. They're about grief, and they have complicated time structures. So I think they have both been called, perhaps erroneously, horror films.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing we're going to talk about is fear. Yeah. And do you think these are horror films?
I don't think either of them are horror films.
I don't think either.
Partly because there was no such thing as a horror film in the silent era.
Which is of course sort of the key line, but
I think David Lowery has said, you know, this isn't even post-horror. There's been a lot of talk about horror that isn't like horror, and I think it's got a lot of genre people that are very agitated. But this, A Ghost Story is not a horror film.
No, whilst there are things in it, there are some jump scares in it.
There are. I think there's a lot of use of that particular kind of structure of time. There are a lot of things that you just, in the cinema, you want to jump, but not in that, I can't believe what I'm about to see, my blood's curdling way.
No, it's gentle in that respect. But it does deal with those things, and, you know, it misses out what might be the horrific part of the film, which is his death.
And the other deaths.
And the other deaths, yes, of course, yes. Yeah, indeed, yes, we'll come to those. Yeah, it's not a horror film, apart from, you know, if we can talk about fear, then there is obviously a degree of existential horror.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting, that the closest thing to a sort of ghost story scene is when Casey Affleck, as the ghost in A Ghost Story, is haunting his house, his old house, and he's at the dinner table. Yeah, so he's playing the poltergeist at the family dinner table, and you see both the effects without him present in the frame and with him present in the frame, and you really feel that it's him that's scared more than they are.
Yeah. And I think you know, it is a haunting, it's a ghost story from the ghost's point of view, which is also the case of The Phantom Carriage as well. You know, it's the story is told fundamentally from the ghost's point of view. And yeah, I would say that David is the ghost we're talking to.
Oh, I see. I don't really think of him as a ghost in the film.
Okay, well, we can argue about that. But you know, he is haunted by new people. He's haunted by new people coming in. He's haunted by the change, and there's this ineffable thing about the house that keeps him there, which I think we eventually probably decide is his own haunting presence. The fact he doesn't want to let life go, but he's not quite sure what it is about life he wants to hold on to.
With David Holm, you know, he has virtually given up on life and all the sort of rules of life. You know, he's going around, he's basically killing people by his entire toxic presence. He's a bit of a ghost or a phantom in real life, So David is kind of a phantom when he's alive, and it's that point of whether he decides he wants to stay alive, whether it's worth it or not, whether hell is preferable.
Well, it feels like a fundamentally selfish choice from his point of view, because the world is better off without him. I don't for a second believe he's going to repent that well. He might for a couple of days. I mean, there's a couple of points in the film where he does repent. There are a couple of times when he comes back and says, I will turn over a new leaf. It doesn't take an awful lot for him to change and be the thoroughly despicable character he is to everyone around him, you know. So it is a bit of a bittersweet ending, I find. And you know, there is this kind of fear, the fear aspect of that he's been given this other chance, you know. I mean, the whole, you know, I suppose the subtext is a bit of a Christmas Carol-y type thing, where this is all his fever drunken dream, I guess. Though if I wanted to think of it as a ghost story, then yeah, for some reason death has given them a reprise, because death hates people who are alive, and he wants them to kill more people with his coughing over them and generally being the most unpleasant man in Sweden.
I mean, he is an agent of death, isn't he? You have to wonder what it is that's scary in this film. So for David, obviously the idea of driving the phantom carriage is terrifying, and quite rightly, and we as an audience, we find that terrifying. But you know, the menace of alcoholism and, you know, of disease is possibly what they're really more interested in and scaring us with.
Yeah, I mean, it's a temperance film. It feels like a temperance film, and it feels like a film about... No, actually, it also feels a little bit a film about partially the kind of the pointlessness of hope and trying to save people, because, you know, Sister Edith, you know, she does... She finally dies happy, thinking that she saved him. She's not really done that. And he's killed her in the process with his horrible ways.
He's killed a lot of people. I don't know. I mean, I think just because you are cynical about the ending, I think, you know, we can't read the entire film through that particular skepticism, because it might not be what the filmmakers intended.
I don't care what the filmmaker intended. This is how I read it.
It is about scaring people straight, really. So it's about what will it take to make you change your ways. You know, obviously Edith tries love, and George and Death try scares. Does anybody need to be frightened in a ghost story? Is there a story there about terrifying people? Because it's all about the ghost's own psyche, really.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the ghost is the ghost scared? I mean, yes, as you said, some points the ghost is scared. Is the ghost, but yeah, I mean, I think the interesting, going back to the Phantom Carriage, I mean, what both have in common, we're going to talk about time in a bit, but the fear of doing this job for 100 years, 36,500 years, but
maths
has to be important. He's no better person to do that job, though, than David Holm. He is callous. He doesn't care. He doesn't care when people die. So actually, if he's going around reaping, there's never going to be a moment where he feels sorry for anyone.
But I think that is slightly cynical reading, because I think in life he has proved to be callous, it's true, but the prospect of doing this job does scare him and does make him realise that he does value human life, that he doesn't want to be on the side of death. So it makes him think about, you know, what he has done in his life, how many lives he's ruined. I mean, he ends up saving his wife and family from the brink of death by stopping the suicide.
For a day or two.
Well, you know, as I say...
Yeah, no, okay, yeah. My cynicism may be overwhelming.
Change his mind about the value of life and whether he really wants to be a killer.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing a ghost story does in that respect is talk about the happy ever after, or what happens after a story's finished. Because, you know, there is a version of this story which is about Rooney Mara's character.
No, there isn't. We don't have films about women.
Sorry, yes, no. What was I thinking? But there is a version of the story which is about that character, her grief, her moving on, her leaving the house, which is an equally interesting story. Her story is over as far as the film is concerned. And, you know, there is a sense early on in the ghost story that the reason he's staying is for her. And we're walking into grief now, so I want to go back to fear.
I wanted to talk about the use of silence in a ghost story.
Yeah.
Because I think that it's a remarkably silent film, as you mentioned, quite rightly. For example, you know, when they have a sort of love scene in bed, when they're cuddling up in bed together just before the ghost makes his appearance, it is so silent on the soundtrack. Obviously, you hear the noises of their bodies. You know, you often hear in the film some ambient noises like birds and things, but there's so much pin drop silence in the first half of this film. And that in itself is quite terrifying. That sets you up in it's quite an old fashioned technique, really. You know something bad's going to happen because this silence is making you so tense.
Yeah, I mean, it plays on certain cinematic language, you know, the cinematic language of silence, of how that works. The quiet, loud, there's just never any loud, or very rarely any loud. We get one little bit haunting, we get some action. I mean, but it's having exactly the same effect. It's having that it's disconcerting, it's weird. Is it subsonics trying to make me feel scared? Is it?
It's an unsettling film, but not in that way that people just try, some films try to make you feel really uncomfortable and gross until the whole thing's over. And it does feel like it carries its own little suspense. I'm not going to talk about about the very end of the film right now, but you do build up and up into a climax. It can only end one way, I think, and it does end suddenly.
It ends that way, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas in Phantom Carriage, they sort of keep taking us into the horror aspect and back again out of it. We sort of wash in and out of seeing the demon carriage. It's pretty terrifying, though.
It has, yeah, it has that. And of course, you know, you mentioned The Shining earlier. The link between that and The Shining is the Here's Johnny sequence in The Shining where he axes his way through the door is in the Phantom Carriage. He breaks down the door with an axe. Yeah. And
it's also in Broken Blossoms 2 years earlier, directed by D.W. Griffith in 1919. That's... But people really like to make a connection between the Phantom Carriage and The Shining, I think, because of the themes.
The horror movies as well,
I also wonder whether, I mean, I have no idea whether Victor Sjöström saw Broken Blossoms. I'm sure he'd have liked it very much. I think hacking through a door with an axe is probably just the way you got through doors.
Yeah, I mean, between the Phantom Carriage and The Shining, there are a number of links around someone's mind going and alcoholism and all these other things.
Absolutely.
So, I think, so if you think about where the fear is in The Phantom Carriage, it is about this violent man, and this unpredictable violent man. And whilst most of his violence is callous and verbal and germ-laden, he's not without moments where he is terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, his wife quite rightly fears for her life sometimes. I'm wondering whether I can compare the feelings of fear I had in the cinema watching these two films. Because I was actually quite scared during Ghost Story, not in a horror story way, but I was quite worried about what was going to happen. I felt like I was at the edge of my seat wondering what was going to occur.
It was uneasy. It's suspenseful.
Yeah.
For a film where very little happens, it's very suspenseful.
Mm.
And I think fear-wise as well, I think you are more likely to have nightmares or tangential nightmares about a ghost story.
It makes the ghost seem so real.
Mm.
Like you feel that there's a physical presence in life that could be something otherworldly.
Yeah, the existential fear is there. If you've ever worried about what happens to you after death or the void or anything like that, that's there. But also the sort of the very basic, you know, the sheet ghost, the bedsheet ghost, or the ghost that's in your cupboard, that when you open it, you half see when you wake up in the middle of the night, and then suddenly your brain slowly coalesces from the information that that's actually just a coat on the back of a chair.
I mean, you know, there are things that I think the ghost is terrified of in a ghost story, and he's scared of losing his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And he's scared of leaving the house. And I think these two things are connected. I think we should talk about those later. I think that we should be more scared by a Phantom Carriage because it's actually talking about what will happen to you if you die a sinner. You'll go to hell and you'll have killed and destroyed the lives of so many people around you. I'm afraid I found a ghost story more terrifying.
Yes. No, I think a ghost story is still a scarier film than the Phantom Carriage, mainly because I don't have any religion. That makes me believe. And also because the Phantom Carriage, it's like, it's a little arbitrary. You know, his hell is driving this van, the carriage, sorry.
The van?
Yeah, driving this milk float.
Is he a white van, man?
The milk float of death. And that's because he died at that particular moment in time. We don't quite know what would happen otherwise. I worry a little bit about Cedric is that surely she has now died. Has been the last person to die on that night. And so it's her job to drive the carriage. It's her job to drive the carriage. So yet again, David has doomed someone else by his selfish actions. I really don't like him.
When she goes, I think God or death, whoever chooses a sinner to die at the last minute. I think we've got to say it's always a bad man.
Okay.
Did you see too much? All the awful dreams felt real at night. Did you know that she waking up? Did she die in the night? Leave you alone.
What is it you like about this house so much?
History?
I want to talk about the use of special effects in the film. Now, they both use very sort of real, low-tech special effects. With Sjöström's film, it's about in-camera double exposure, so we were rewinding the film to shoot things again and again. So it looks ethereal, but that's really what was in front of the camera all those times, you know? And in A Ghost Story, it's an incredibly complicated sheet.
Yes, it is. It's a much harder sheet than having read about it. It's a much more complicated sheet than you would think. They tried it with a sheet. It didn't work. The eyes kept on slipping. You could see Casey Affleck acting underneath the sheet.
When it's not the art director, apparently, giving Casey Affleck the afternoon off.
Yes, well, indeed. And who knows? It's yeah, I mean, putting Casey Affleck under a sheet may or may not enhance his performance in this film. I don't know. So, and also from what I understand, research from is that that would all have been hand cranked as well. So you're looking at matching movements and sequences.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a lot of that where there's much interaction between the living and dead, but there are definitely some sequences where you've got to get that timing right.
Yeah.
So that seems incredibly complicated.
Yeah, it is. And it does have the most fantastic effect. And are you talking about each exposure being lit in a different way, so they all appear slightly different? And of course you've got the two, you could call them ghosts, you've got George and David sitting in the graveyard. You know, it's interesting to see two sort of spectral presences sitting in amongst all the dead and on the headstones and things like that. It always works fantastically well. It's difficult for us now because we've seen that effect so many times done and in easier ways, whereas it's actually a shock. It's a real shock to see this heavy canvas sheet that's so beautifully folded and lit and never slips, and just it drags across the floor. And as he haunts, it gets more and more ragged and dusty. It's very, it's very kind of like Marley's ghost, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's
really phenomenal, the sheet work.
And he's not the only ghost in it, of course. No. There is a ghost in the house next door.
She's a lady ghost because she's got flowers on her sheet.
She's got flowers on her sheet. And we also know that she's played by Kesha.
Yes. Yes.
Which is a little bit random, but, you know.
Here's a bit we can't put in the podcast. Kesha and Casey Affleck in the same film together. Wonder what they talked about.
Yeah, good question. I would keep that in.
I mean, it's really fantastic, actually. One of the things, it's a simple special effect, I suppose. We have the two ghosts in neighbouring houses looking at each other through the windows. And how do they communicate? They don't say anything. So we just have a subtitle. We have ghost language. Yeah. We have the sort of representation of their telepathic connection.
Yeah, and there is a suggestion also that there is very little there. So the one that's, what are you waiting for? I'm waiting for something. What are you waiting for? I don't know. You know, who are you waiting for? I don't know. And the degree to which... it's one of the few things that gets you inside the head of the ghosts. We never see that from Affleck ghost.
I think we have the same thing. He knows he's waiting there. I think the fact that he keeps trying to get the message from Rooney Mara, I think we know exactly what he's there. He's basically waiting for her to come back. Right?
Yes. Yeah, but or is he? Because does it come to a point where he just gets trapped in the motion? He gets trapped. So, you know, he did know why he was there, and he was there for the grief. And when the grief went, when she left, he should have gone. Or when was there a point, but now there's this message and he needs that message. But, and you know, obviously we don't see that message. I think, again, the correct choice. Because it doesn't really matter.
Oh, well, I have a lot of thoughts about the message.
One of the biggest special effects in the film, or not special effects, is the demolition of the house.
Yeah, it's a great effect.
Which was happening anyway, so that's how they got to film there. the house is going to be demolished, and so they just put that in the film. I mean, it was all done on the cheap in that way. And he's there. Whether he's actually standing, he's actually standing in the house when it gets demolished, or whether they put a thing on a mannequin under a sheet for that brief moment of puppeteering.
I mean, I think what is interesting when we talk about special effects in films. So it's not like that. They really demolish the house and there's really a man in a sheet. But actually, there are some more complicated special effects. Now, obviously, the poltergeist, but one of the things I really like, and this is one of the really fascinating things about the films, that it veers between being funny and being terribly sad. When the ghost jumps off a very tall building because he's horrified by the corporate world, and who wouldn't be? Instead of falling like a person does, horizontal, he goes nose first like a little shuttlecock, and it's just utterly bizarre. Yeah. And you realise he'll never fall to ground like that. That's when he falls through time.
Yeah.
And yet it's the physicality of it that you remember.
Yes. And yeah, I think the visuals of that stuff as well are just great, because it's quite a short bit of the film, that, but it is it's what's leaving us going, how long are we going to be here for? How forward are we going to go? You know, he's tied to that place, but was that place the house? And when he goes back to the moment it was claimed by white settlers. He doesn't go back to, you know, as Malick might have done, to the dinosaurs or previous to that. There's a moment that is the start of his line. And it might be from the minute that plot was marked out, and that's what the film suggests. And at that point I rolled my eyes and went, oh, you know, come on, there were people here before white people.
Yeah,
which it then deals with in a very effective way, I think.
They make their presence felt,
yes,
don't they?
They do.
And of course the little girl in that family, just like Rooney Mara, she leaves a note.
Yeah. Under the rock.
So I suppose one of the things we say with the ghost story is that it uses special effects. It's almost like a bit of a dare. The way it dares to show you something beyond the physical realm. But it makes you realise that virtually everything's a special effect. The fact that we can have people walk on in costume and suddenly we think that we're in the 19th century in pioneer days, you know, that's not a thing. The shots of the decaying corpse, we know it's not the same girl.
Yeah.
It really begins to make you think about how the film constructs itself. In a good way, I think, just because the film itself is a little puzzle to be unlocked.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think what's nice about it in that respect is that it plays with, you know you have special effects in these kind of films, but we get the glowing door. It's probably the only real thing that would leap out and you go, oh, that's a real special effect. Because what we don't have is double exposure. We don't have him walking through walls. We don't have that, you know, when he's in a room with people, they just don't see him.
Yeah.
There's a moment where she brushes his hem and things like that.
When she reaches her hand out and she nearly touches the hem of his sheet. Oh, it was so moving.
Yeah.
Listening to his song.
So these are all constructed moments. You know, she is like, you know, we've gone from a sequence of him writing a song to the sequence of her listening to that song. And it's seamlessly matched continuity wise, though the sound is not seamlessly matched. So it goes,
she's got rubbish headphones.
Goes into her rubbish headphones. And it's it shows its hand. And what you were saying earlier about soundtrack is how soundtracks are keyed in to give you continuity. So if you've got absolute silence, that's hard for a film sometimes. So yeah, really interesting, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm going to give special effects to Ghost Story, but I think I know what I'm going to do later.
Well, I'm going to give special effects to Phantom Carriage, because I think that as a pioneer in this area, and I think also because there's so much of it that it is used very, very well. You know, there's this three-dimensionalness to it. There's a way it interlocks with itself. I think that it's impressive, and so I will give it to
that. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. You're probably right. You're probably right.
We are allowed to agree to disagree.
So I want to talk about grief.
Mm.
So in The Phantom Carriage, no one quite dies, do they? Not that we see.
Edith dies. Yes. Edith does die, but
we don't see. We see people worrying about people, so grieving people before they've actually died. So her mother is sorry and says, you know, I want to have her now. The Salvation Army had her. We have the wife who pretty much has suffered the loss of her husband, even though, you know, when he comes back, that's not great either. And, you know, the sorrow with which she decides that they should exit.
Yeah. And, of course, we don't really know. I mean, the whole Sister Edith stuff is, if this is all in Holmes' fever dream, we don't even know if any of that's happening at all.
But I do think that it is a film that feels like it's saturated with grief. There's a lot of loss and a lot of concern for people's mortal and immortal beings.
It's saturated with death, certainly.
Yeah.
And so I think grief comes with that. I think it's interesting around just the tale of the Phantom Carriage and George, who then vanished and now is driving the Phantom Carriage. And again, that these things have conflated in David Holmes' mind to that point, is that he's decided that the man who is most afraid of this fate is the man doing it. And, you know, and George is like sitting there going, well, I'm responsible for your terrible predicament. You're not. David is responsible for his own actions, thank you very much. But, you know, there's that side of it. You know, has he left him to drive it for 100 years? I don't know. There's no grief there, but there is that grief of loss, and there is a grief of lost souls, I guess. So Edith grieves for David's soul.
Because I think that's the thing. I think for the Salvation Army and for Christians of that particular stripe, when they see someone like David, they grieve for a lost soul. I think that's exactly the phrase, you know, because they won't enter the kingdom of heaven, you know, and it's another soul lost. And so I think there is a grief there. And when he rejects their help, you know, that grief intensifies. The fact that Edith is so sort of set on saving this one particular soul, you know, there's maybe a certain kind of mania there. I don't know.
Yeah. The idea that he is her pinnacle. If she can save his soul, then she can go to heaven. She's only been at this game for a year or so. And, you know, if she'd thought a little bit more about washing the clothes before she sewed them up, then maybe she wouldn't have got TB.
If only the sterilisation oven was quite up and running.
Always check your sterilisation oven before New Year's Eve.
To be clear, if anyone hasn't seen this film for a long time, David Holmes does some terrible, despicable things, but by far the worst, most brutal moment in the film is when he unpicks the patches that she has sewed into his jacket while he slept.
When he sees his jacket, when he sees him, he can't imagine or believe that anyone would be kind to him. And there's a brief moment, when we think, oh, okay, all right, there's a little bit of redemption here, which is how he's going to save us. And then she comes out and he just turns on a dime and becomes, and just rips it apart. And he just says, I'm sorry I wasted you. Sorry you wasted your time here, but I like it was, and rips it apart. It's horrible.
Grief is obviously a lot clearer a subject in a ghost story where we see, was a 4-minute shot of Rooney Mara cry eating chocolate pie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty brutal. I remember thinking when I watched that scene, I mean, she's got tears streaming down her face. It's sort of a long shot. And I was part thinking, this is quite uncomfortable. This is quite daring to do this for so long. Some people would find this boring. But then I was also finding myself unbearably moved by it.
The person sitting 3 seats down from me was sobbing through because she absolutely sobbed through that. It's weird, actually, the ghost story didn't move me to tears. And I'm a relatively easy crier in cinema. It moved me a lot, but it didn't make me want to cry. And I think that's kind of because it wasn't that kind of grief for me. And because the film deals with her grief. She deals with her grief. And we see her deal with her grief.
I mean, I think there are question marks over their relationship to begin with. They're trying to talk about things and she wants to talk about them and he doesn't. One of the things that happens in one of the haunting sequences is that she brings another man home. He sees her with another man. And I have to say, we don't actually know where that comes in the chronology. So that could have been while they were still together.
Yeah.
Because he says, you know, I like this house because we've got history. And she says, not as much as you think.
Yeah.
And I think this is the thing. He, as a ghost, he wants to cling to the house and the idea of his happy relationship with M. But this is when I really start thinking of my various things that could be in the note. What do you think the note says?
I think the note says goodbye.
Oh, that's nice.
I mean, I don't really care what the note says. And I think
care deeply what the note says.
But then, you know, she sets up this thing about, you know, putting notes in walls. She doesn't really say kind of what she is, what she's saying in there. She might be saying
the
goodbye to him.
The thing she wants to remember.
Yeah, so, you know, it might be. She's got the thing. I think the only thing of worth he ever does is this one song. It appears.
Well,
I mean,
his legacy, that's he's driving to immortality through his art, as Will Holden explains us.
Yes, Will Holden does have this. I mean, that sequence is, it's this moment of amazing sixth form pretension where this ghost hunter stroke, or they're at this party that's in the house, which is identified as haunted, and that's why they're there. Just goes through, you know, beginner's guide to metaphysics, but in just such a mansplaining way.
He's so brutal to people with children. Your children will die, their children will die.
I mean, he's not wrong, but he's super annoying, and he's actually quite funny because of it. And but
it's
also
a party.
And he's probably got more dialogue than anyone in the film.
Yeah, it's a long speech.
It's his long speech, and then the film goes quiet after that, and we get to sit there and contemplate that and say, is that where this is going? Is that the philosophy of the film, or is it something else?
Well, you see, so this idea of legacy and it being important to leave something behind. So obviously, Rooney Mara's character leaves something behind wherever she's lived, and that's what sort of that's something that the ghost fixates on. So I thought one of the many moving scenes I thought was during the demolition sequence when Keisha's ghost says, I don't think they're ever coming back. The person she's waiting for is, I just don't think they're coming back. And that's when, as a ghost, she disappears.
Goes,
and I think the idea that the ghost is sustained by hope is important to C's character. I think the note might say, I'm never coming back here, because she doesn't like the house. And she says,
no, I like that. That's a good call.
I think it could more prosaically say, this is the house where I fell out of love with C.
Yeah.
And it could say what the settler girl's note should say, which is, I shouldn't be here.
Yeah, I should never come here.
Yeah.
Because there's a wonderful
sequence.
And all
those things would destroy him.
Yeah, there's a wonderful sequence when they are looking at the house and he gets it straight away. And she's kind of, it's all right.
Yeah.
It's a house.
Yeah.
Not sure I want to be here. I mean, she's used to moving on. She's used to change. He clearly isn't.
No. One of the things that's really spooky is, do you notice at the beginning when she's looking at houses on her iPad or whatever, she's looking at the floor plan of a house. It could be one just like the one she's in. And the next thing that swipes into her screen is the office block.
I didn't notice that, so.
Because I remember thinking, she doesn't want to move to a high rise. Look at these hipsters. No. And of course, that's what's to come. That's what's to be built.
Yeah. The film is about grief, but it is about the ghost's grief. I mean, we do see her grieving. Her grieving stuff is really important and interesting. I think that offers hope for people as well who are grieving that it will be over.
Well, that's the thing. She, because she has a normal time frame.
Yeah.
she sort of moves on with her life. She's a young woman. She might go meet someone else. She might just move somewhere else. She might always love him, but still be able to be happy with someone else. All these things we can imagine. What is horrifying to us, I think, is the idea of being stuck in that moment of grieving someone never for decades, for centuries, and never being away from it. Because yeah. These ghosts look so sad with their little droopy eyes.
Just drawn that way.
But yeah, I'm not sad. I'm just drawn that way.
I suppose the horror, as we're going back to the horror in both of them, but also the grief around both of them, sits around having this time to think. So, you know, when you're driving the milk float of death, all you're doing is reaping souls and thinking about your own loss and the mistakes you've made. Perhaps this is the same here. He's thinking about the mistakes he's made. Yeah. I think it's
but
more
he can't
about,
do anything about it.
Yeah, he can't do anything about it. And I think he's losing his sense of self as well. So all that becomes left of him is this space, that message. I need that message, and now I've come unhinged in time, so I have to wait for that message to come around again. And watch it all happen and haunt myself.
Yeah, his frustration and pain when he sees them together, and it's, you know, well, yeah.
What can I do?
The piano chord moment is really, really brutal. I feel that any film in which you see a mother preparing to kill her children must win in the emotional stakes, but...
This is a film about grief. There's only one winner here, I think. Yeah. It's a ghost story about grief.
Yeah. No place like home, there's a business.
A writer writes a novel. A songwriter writes a song. We do what we can to endure.
So here's an interesting topic with the sheets and all. When it comes to performances. Now, I'm obviously going to love all the performances in these films because I like a silent performance.
Yes.
I like Act with To Me Only With Thine Eyes.
Yeah.
Which Rooney Mara is fantastic at.
She's got some... I never used to get Rooney Mara, and then after Carol...
Oh, Carol,
Carol, I completely got her. And now I see her and say, okay, I work how this works. I mean, go back to the pie sequence, which is silent, you know, and
so
she's just...
fork on the tin.
Fork on the tin and just down there. And basically this pie has been left for her by her estate agent come neighbour. And she just looks at it and then just goes, I'll have this. And in she goes. And it's a brutal sequence. The ghost is watching from, I think, pretty much exactly the same distance that we are. It's almost like a mirror. We're watching and being voyeurs, and we can do nothing about it. And then at the end of it, she's overwhelmed sick. And sick. Yeah,
she's sick. And you don't know whether that's because... she's eaten a lot of pie, she's got bulimia type issues or something like that.
Or it's a grief thing or something. Yeah. It's a way of acting out your, you know, it is a grief response sometimes. She is sad, and it doesn't matter what their relationship was like at that point. It doesn't take away the feeling that you're never going to see someone again and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's...
That's a pretty powerful performance. I would give Casey Affleck less time. Because he has less time to impress me.
He gets less time to impress you. I think he is very impressive and very convincing as a feckless man-child.
I recently watched, again, To Die For. I think it's one of his first roles. Mm. He plays such a despicable young man in that. He's so vicious. And so I think there's always something a bit shifty about his appearance on screen. So you do wonder what kind of boyfriend he was. We need to talk about Victor Sjöström, though.
Yes.
Because I think that David Holm is just really one of the great silent screen performances.
It's so despicable. He's so watchable and he's so horrible, and yet you want to see what happens. It's just an amazing performance.
I always think, like, when I was watching it again, you know, I was really focusing on that rather than looking at all the special effects and flashiness. You know, he's so comfortable with going to quite dark spaces and acting the violence towards his wife and things like that, that you can sort of see, you know, I don't know if you've seen Wild Strawberries.
Yeah,
the sequence in that where Sjöström is inside the coffin,
yeah,
which I think, you know, he was quite encouraging Bergman to do. And, you know, this, he doesn't have any fear whatsoever of playing dark, and yet he's so charismatic. You see him as the drinking buddy, you see he would be the center of the tavern, and you know he's handsome underneath all that. Somewhere underneath all that, there's the man that Sister Edith fell in love with. I think also the wife is phenomenally good, just because her character changes so much. We see her distraught and at her wit's end. We see her younger and happier and more confident. She goes through a few more changes than some of the other characters do.
I mean, I think it's interesting seeing, you know, Sjöström as an actor, and directing himself, and sort of, you know, he's a good director of actors. He understands that, and he gets his actors to go to some relatively brutal places themselves in other films.
Well, I mean, we were talking about Lillian Gish in The Wind,
which
I think he made very soon after this film. I think this was the film that made Hollywood
sit up and listen.
Call him up on the phone.
I know, and it makes sense, but if you look at the where he gets Lillian Gish to go, when he look at the drunken performances in that film around that, you know, the level of despicableness of the men. He could probably sit down and say, see this film, this is what I want you to do here. This is how I want you to play a drunk. And it's not just falling over, it's being mean, sort of mean, nasty drunk.
But I think, you know, this is really one of the sort of big characterizations.
Yeah.
There's far more acting in The Phantom Carriage than there is in, say,
A Ghost Story. But, of course, and the question is, what kind of acting can you get out of a relatively immobile sheet?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can talk about deadpan, we can talk about people who don't emote much, you know, your steely-faced heroes and stuff like that. But this gives you next to nothing, tiny bits of physical movement, and that's the point.
But that's interesting, isn't it? Because imagine not being this gesturing, wobbling, trembling, speaking, breathing person, but just being able to move to things. There's an awful lot of the ghost standing still and turning his body to look at things, and just existing as a body in space and not all the kind of floaty extras that we add
on. I think so. It's interesting. I'm reading some of the notes on the film about how some of those things came out of the physical limitations of using the sheet.
The heavy sheet.
But at the same time, it was about, this is how I want the ghost to move.
Mm-hmm.
This is how I want it to interact with its... So I want the sheet to get tatty at the bottom. I want it to get dirty up to a point. You know, it never gets so dirty and so ragged.
Well, it never loses its integrity, does it?
In any way. It has, of course, that one great special effect at the end of both of the ghosts' lives, if you will, when they just go like that and the sheet just falls down when their time on earth is done. Casey Affleck gets top billing in this film.
I wonder why.
I
think Rooney Mara has even said, I did a lot of acting while he sort of stood under a sheet.
Yeah.
I mean, she probably put it in a much more sophisticated way than that.
Yes.
I think it's intriguing because Phantom Carriage is remembered as this horror film and with this spooky special effects. But actually, when I come back to it, it's the performances that really drag me in. Even though I think when it opens, you know, you feel like you're in the world of melodrama, you feel like the acting might be a little broad, it really suckers you in. And actually, I think that's what you expect.
I do think that he elevates it, considering George is very good as well.
He is. I mean,
bouncing off him.
I mean, I think with George and David, it's just that thing of how attractive the devil might be, really. You know, that these are sort of garrulous types. Oh, you'd been to the university, so he knew more than us.
Yeah.
He's just another drunken bum like the rest of you.
Exactly, And of course, a lot of this acting is done translucent at best.
You do see them.
But there is a bit of extra work to be done there. I think if we're gonna judge the performances, I will go for The Phantom Carriage.
I'm going for The Phantom Carriage. Sorry, Rooney, we love you. But so, cinematography. One thing we haven't mentioned about A Ghost Story, because I think with the ghosts and the pie and everything, you forget, is the frame of it.
So it's in Academy ratio with rounded corners.
Rounded corners, which you said weren't properly masked.
Weren't probably masked in my cinema, no, unfortunately.
Well, shout out to the Empire Walthamstow, which had perfect screening of this film.
I should see all my films in Walthamstow, obviously.
Well, you should, because the more good films people go to see at that cinema, the more good films they'll show. So I'm very grateful that they showed this. I think it's quite good. They're showing it twice a night. So.
Yeah. I mean, I was quite impressed looking at how wide a release it's got. I don't know how it will have done. I hope it gets into the top 10 so I can hear people moan about it later and in reviews and go, it wasn't what I expected. It's called A Ghost Story and there was a ghost in it, but it wasn't scary. It's like, it's not called a scary ghost story.
I'm assuming that if you go to see this with a group of people, it is the law that one person will want to leave. Even if they don't leave, when you're talking about it in the restaurant, the pub later, they'll be saying, that wasn't even a film. That wasn't a ghost. Nothing happened. I mean, almost you could see, you know. And so I was describing the film to my partner when I got in, and I think he was quite intrigued. And I was like, yeah, still, you might have hated it though.
But also, it's one of those useful things where you might go out with it. I don't see it as being a big Saturday night going out with all your mates. But if you did, it might give you a hint of which one of your mates you might not want to hang out with so much anymore, the one who doesn't get it. Because there isn't much to get, but we have strayed from cinematography.
I was talking about it with someone else who had heard all about the film and hadn't seen it. And we were just saying, so people like this? People like this? Really? What do they like about it? We'd have no idea. Well, we'll see it, but we can't promise anything. And of course, read a little bit more about it, got quite intrigued. And then I was absolutely besotted, really, when I saw it. So anyway, the cinematography. So it has these curved frames and it's in colour, although it's very muted palette. So what it made me think of, rather than thinking it's Academy Ratio, return to classic golden age cinema, it made me think of home movies.
Yeah, home movies, old photos. There's a desaturatedness about it in places, though, you know, it's not afraid to go to the colours. I mean, the Pioneer sequence is much brighter.
It's all outside. Pastels, yeah.
It's outdoor light. It's natural light, and whereas the house is...
It's very blue-grey.
Very blue-grey. It's the light that's filtered through the windows. I'm assuming there's not that much internal lighting in there. Probably is some, because, you know, can't do it without it. But and certainly, you know, he's been a big fan of shooting that way in the past as well. Mm. These are the colours he likes. You know, you see Pete's Dragon, it's a very green and blue film.
Yeah.
And has a very similar aesthetic. And this is where, and I don't want to talk about Malick really, but this is where people have talked about Malick, and actually this is where I think he's quite different. That I think he understands how light works in that way, but isn't besotted by it.
And we've got more kind of dusk and twilight than dawn than we have here than anything like the Magic Hour, which is what you associate with the Malick type thing. I was saying it's interesting compared to Malick, instead of sort of expanding, although the film goes in lots of different directions, it does feel, even though there are still mysteries, as we said, it does feel like it ties itself up at the end. It's very it's called A Story.
It feels like a ghost story. It rocks in at an hour and a half, which is something else that Malick has not been able to do very recently. It's a very taut film. It knows what it's doing.
And that seems to be reflected in this square frame.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many moments in the film where I thought, you know, that I feel like this is from some series of art photographs that could be hanging in a gallery wall. Yeah. Like you said, gallery too. The still images, as it were, of the ghost in the house works so well, and that I think is to do with the quality of the tone of the light that they use, because otherwise, I mean, all you need to do is raise one arm and it's hilarious.
Well, it's a white sheet, isn't it? Yeah. So a white sheet would pop on any kind of artificial lighting, too much artificial lighting. I mean, it's the classic ghost story photo, isn't it, where you look in the old photo from 50 years ago and there's your gran and your granddad and the whole family, and just in the background there's a spectral image. And of course this isn't see-through, there isn't anything spectral here, but it is there in the background often as things are going on around it, impassive but there.
He's not translucent, but he's fluid. There's something about he moves in an unusual way.
It's not quite floating. I don't think he's on roller skates under there or on a trolley. I think he is walking, but when he does walk, he is walking slowly and steadily. You know, it's not the hardest job in the world for an actor, but you know, I'll give him kudos for that.
Hey Gacy, can you walk in a straight line? What of it?
A sheet over your head.
Well, I don't know. Might have a job for you.
Yeah. Though cinematography-wise, Phantom Carriage is also gorgeous.
Absolutely blows me away. So we credit Julian Jansen, who made things like, have you ever seen Her Honest Treasure?
I don't think I have, no.
Such a beautiful film. Lots of great films. It's quite deep focus. There's so much detail. Everything is shot in order to look either... Well, a lot of it's quite beautiful, even though it's haunting. The scenes in the tenement with the family are so gritty and dirty and sad. The terrifying shadows that David Holm and Sister Edith throw on the door during that brutal coat sequence.
Yes.
You know, from the pie sequence to the coat sequence, these are the two highlights of the film. I think that everything about the play of light in Phantom Carriage is just stunning, and I would like to watch it again and again. Watching it at the Cinémathèque Française was mind-blowing.
I can imagine. I think what impressed me about it was the sense of space and you see depth of field. When you're outdoors, when we're in the graveyard, it feels like a graveyard. When you're indoors in the Salvation Army, you get a sense of where everything is, how this
prison,
room works. Prison, exactly. Yeah, you get all these senses, and the lighting and the way it's shot and the placement of people. You know, there are very few close-ups. There are some, but there are very few. People are often reacting with people or reacting to something in the scene. And the setups are just great. You know, there's constant tension within the sequences that leads it forward. For a film which is 90% flashback, or you know, 85% flashbacks, and where these flashbacks sit are not, it's not always the best thing, but...
I would like to celebrate A Ghost Story as a modern high point in cinematography in many ways. I think that it's very creative and it's exquisitely done, but I think I have to go with Phantom Carriage. It takes my breath away.
This might be the first time I've disagreed with you, I'm not sure, but I am going to go with A Ghost Story.
Disagreed with me many times, including today. You have at least once.
Partially also because I think the cinematography does lean a little bit on horror film cinematography in places with some of that dusk stuff.
Mm.
And I think so. And when we were talking about tension before, how it brings up that tension within the frame.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, so you voted for a ghost story. I voted for Phantom Carriage. We're going to our final category. And this is time. Now, I would argue that both of these films, in their own way, could teach Christopher Nolan a thing or two about manipulating different timelines.
Yeah, now, I do think that Phantom Carriage almost gets tripped up with its never-ending flashbacks. But
it's all carefully done, though.
It is carefully done. Like, I think that's a thing.
Because I think they spring a bit of a surprise on you to find out how much time Edith has spent with David in the preceding year trying to save him. You know, you think that this is just a chance encounter. Maybe there's, you know, I don't know what you assume until then.
The setup and the framing of the film is around her death, and she wants to see him one time before she dies to prove that maybe she's had some kind of effect. And then it becomes David's story. And you said, why is that? What is? And you don't really find out until the last half hour why she cares so much.
Yeah.
It's, from a time point of view, it's hanging that on you constantly whilst telling this other story about this fantastic, despicable man, which in itself wouldn't be that compelling if it wasn't A, super, really well acted, and B, in this framework where we think it's going to go somewhere. It is an interesting one.
I feel like you lost your patience with it a little bit.
I lost my patience with a couple of the flashbacks, just because it was a bit, now, well, it does that Christmas Carol thing. And now let's tell you about this time when you were terrible. Now let's tell you about this time when you were terrible. Yeah, I did lose a little bit of patience, and flashbacks aren't without problems sometimes. But I do think in the end it does do them all chronologically pretty much.
I think you always know where you are. It's interesting. I think it uses flashback in a way like cross-cutting, you know, to the parallel lines of action. You know, just when you're worried about Sister Edith, you start worrying about the wife. Just when you're worried about the wife, you start worrying about David. And I think it gives you kind of grief tension or something.
Yeah, and everything is kind of taking place at this stroke of midnight as well. So there is this kind of, I'm going to tell you this story now. It's like, I understand from your point of view, George, that you want to ditch this job. You could just leave, you know, and just make him do it. You know, it's.
I think your over literal interpretation of everything in the Phantom Carriage is quite bizarre.
It's like the I have similar problems with Gremlins. You know, anything that has a hard deadline of midnight. It's like, so what happens? Does he do the whole world? Does he just do this part of the world? I don't know. It's not
clear.
How did you
get on with Father Christmas, the child?
I never believed. Oh. There was never a moment when I believed in Father Christmas. A ghost story also employs flashbacks as well as its loose timeline. It doesn't matter in a ghost story so much when things take place. I think that's quite interesting about it.
I mean, so largely we have, say now, 2017, let's say the car crashes now.
Yeah.
Then we go up to about 2020, 2022, we go back to 1870, and all the, so there's no elegant balance there. But, and I think that the ghost story is just expert at manipulating this and making it all seem part of a cohesive whole. I think that just because there's no neat symmetry, because it isn't all in 12 months or something like that. Oh, God, I really hope that David Lowery has seen and liked The Phantom Carriage, because I do think they're getting at some similar things. I'm trying to incorporate supernatural into real life, and this idea of things happening at their own time and in the film time, but not in a too showy way, not in a kind of Jean-Luc Godard way.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, and that sort of telescoping the time into the future could be considerably longer as well. They move out, the house stays empty for a bit, Spanish family moves in, so we don't know when the development's going to happen. It feels longer to me than say 3 or 4 years when that development goes up. And how long is he at what point in the building of the development? Because it strikes me, to get to that point, we need to have quite a lot of building around it, because it looks like the city is encroaching on the whole area. So
it could be much further.
So I'm
actually
thinking,
yeah,
I'm
no.
I was thinking 50, 60, maybe 100 years.
Yeah, yeah, it's true, actually.
And he's still standing there. And when he gets to the point, he's like, I'm not going to find the thing I want here anymore. Which if it was the note, then he would have known that from the minute the house got knocked down. And maybe he hasn't got the ability or understanding of how to become unhinged in time and go back.
Yeah.
And and there's a whole load of this. There's a good 100, 200 years that we don't see, which is fine. I didn't need to see it. It's an hour and a half long, and that's hooray. As we keep saying, we champion our short films. It's shorter than The Phantom Carriage.
Yes, it is shorter than The Phantom Carriage, which is unusual in this scenario. one of the things that's interesting, when we talk about grief, we always say, you know, time heals. And in Phantom Carriage, people are given enough time and they talk about the soul maturing. There is a definite sense that time improves things. Whereas one of the things that I think is really quite striking in A Ghost Story is the violence of time passing. So obviously the effect that time has on the dead bodies in the settler sequence, it's very violent. Obviously, they're not any more dead. But I mean, it's vicious to see, you know, that beautiful girl and then beautiful girl with a wound and then a beautiful girl who just, you know, decayed and a skeleton and things like that.
And the also, way that he's standing there watching that happening.
When he looks back each time, I mean, I think it's really quite chilling when I think about it. I'm glad I scored Ghost Story high for fear. I think, but you know, the violence of time on the house too, to go from being this young couple's house to a family home, that feels like a natural progression, although that family's a single parent family, so there's almost a mirror of the loss there. And then shabby party house.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes a haunted house. And so if you think about what the standard haunted house is, that one down the end of the road, which is falling apart and looks old. And so that's what this becomes.
When you see the house, it's ready for demolition, though we don't know that yet. We see that the jagged tears in the wall and the state, the mouldings have come away, and the violence that time and obviously some neglectful ownership has done to the house itself is really quite upsetting. I found that's one of the other things I found quite moving.
Well, I think there's an aspect, of course, that that's his fault. Because it becomes a haunted house because he haunts it. That his one interaction.
He, like David Holmes, is a toxic presence in the world.
Yeah, I would agree. It is about time, you know, which is, I believe, the tagline of the film. I believe is the tagline to A Ghost Story is it's all about time.
Really?
Is the tagline to the film.
Well, it's about time David Lowery made another film because Pete loved Pete's Dragon so much. He hasn't been able to stop talking about it.
He only made me wait for a year, and his next one's out next year, though, more Casey Affleck and Robert Redford.
Oh, is this The Old Man and the Gun?
Yes,
Old Man I'm and very the Gun, yes. keen to see more Lowery now.
Yes. I revisited Pete's Dragon recently and then saw Ain't the Body Saints last night. Ain't the Body Saints not without its flaws, but is an interesting movie.
You're haunting the scenes of your previous cinematic delight.
My thing about Pete's Dragon is very much that I hated the original Pete's Dragon as a kid, as someone called Pete, and it being a terrible film. And this one is just a beautiful, really nice sort of mixture of E.T. and The Jungle Book, which is just great.
I must watch Pete's Dragon sometime. Heard about it.
I know, I've got a terrible feeling of going, why am I wasting my time watching this movie? But watch it, please, because it is a great movie.
We are going to have to score these films on their manipulation of time. And, it's a close one.
I'm going to give it to A Ghost Story.
I am too, but I feel like, sometimes I feel with these things, when the silent film lags behind, it's a bit, you know, they wouldn't have made this without that. It's not close at all.
Is it not?
It's 8 to A Ghost Story and 4 to The Phantom Carriage. This isn't always the case with this. I think we've struck upon a good double bill.
When I came out of A Ghost Story, you said, is it any good? And I went, well, I want to predate you. I said, yeah, but it's a really good pairing.
But I didn't read your message until after I came out of the cinema myself. I don't know why, halfway through the afternoon, I just thought, I'll say, is it all that? Because I still couldn't believe that this film could be what it promised to be.
Yeah, and it is, I think. I think it really does do what it does. I mean, and most of the criticisms I have for it answered within its own running time. So
I think that we might suggest that. Always feel like I'm going to want the silent film to win.
Yeah.
Which is silly, because I'd also like cinema to be getting better and better in the whole scheme of things. I'm quite glad when a film like this, which is a small film, which, as you say, it's had a wide opening, but I'm not really sure, you know, how well it's doing. I'm sure that glad that we can champion it, because I really think that this is a fantastic film, and I hope that people do get a chance to watch it on the big screen, because there won't be anything better than being under its spell that way.
No, I mean,
it is a film, it's enough of a ghost story that it's worth watching it in a dark room.
Yeah.
Same with The Phantom Carriage.
Yes, if you can see The Phantom Carriage in the cinema, and I would like to see that in the cinema, but definitely go and see The Ghost Story while it's out there, for all the reasons Pam just said, and also because it's Casey Affleck under a sheet, and frankly, you'll never see him better.
So thank you, people, you lovely people, whether living or dead, for listening to The Sound Barrier. A Ghost Story is out in cinemas now, so do make sure you catch it on the big screen. The Phantom Carriage is available to stream on Amazon Video. The Sound Barrier is presented in association with SOAS Radio, so we thank them very much, and thanks to Pete too.
Thank you.
If you have any spooky suggestions for films we could match up, then please do let us know in the comments on silentlondon.co.uk or tweet us at Silent London. You can find more episodes of the Silent London podcast, including 7 previous editions of The Sound Barrier. Can you believe this is number 8?
I can.
On iTunes or Stitcher. The next episode of The Sound Barrier will be with you in a fortnight, and we'll be announcing the films for that instalment in advance if you'd like to watch what we're watching.
See you later.
Goodbye.
If I walk down this hallway tonight,
It's too quiet, so I pet through the dark and call you on the phone. Push your old numbers and let your house ring till I wake your ghost.
I also have one like really flippant thing to say, which is that A Ghost Story is a film about social media. It's got the Snapchat avatar inside an Instagram frame. It's dealing with the horrors of a non-chronological timeline, desperately trying to recover a lost message.
Let him walk down your hallway. It's not this quiet. Slide down your